Bookstack with Richard Aldous, the Books and Ideas podcast brought to you by AmericanPurpose.com. We're recording live in front of an audience of American Purpose readers. If you'd like to find out more and join us for future recordings, just go to AmericanPurpose.com/join. Coming up on the show today, Seth Kaplan, author of the new book, Fragile Neighborhoods, Repairing American Society, One Zip Code at a Time. Seth, welcome to Bookstack.
Great pleasure to be with you today, Richard.
So congratulations on the new book. What are these fragile neighborhoods?
Fragile neighborhoods is a way to frame how disconnection affects us in our lives. And I look at two types of fragile neighborhoods. I look at the marginalized places that are very much full of, I would say, poor people, been underinvested in, often a legacy of segregation. Or, I mean, it's not only Black, because you can see it in Appalachia, you can see it on in reservations, but it's the parts of our country that are not only disconnected internally, but also disconnected from the rest of the country. And so the most obvious type of fragile neighborhood you have in a place like the United States are the places that are, we could say, spatial inequality, places that are simply concentration of poor people. But I think there's a larger issue of disconnection that we're talking about here. And that's why I dedicate a whole chapter to looking at places that are materially well off, but also because of disconnection are now seeing problems of loneliness, problems of depression, problems of mental illness. And so I think disconnection and the increasing fragility of our society, and this is not only a problem of the United States, because this morning I'm speaking to someone from Australia, and I speak to people from Canada, I speak to people from Denmark. I think it's broadly happening to more in wealthier countries, but I would say the United States, partly because of its history, partly because of its size, partly because of some of the policies that it's selected, it is particularly having problems of social fragility.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you use the word society there, because a lot of your previous work has been on fragile states. But the U.S. is not a fragile state, you point out. As a state, we're doing a lot right. As you say there, it's as a society that we seem to be in more trouble.
Yes. Again, if you look at my background and you say, why is this person writing about neighborhoods when he spent a good chunk of his career writing about states? I mean, just within this week, I'm working on Nigeria. I'm working on Libya. I've been to Ukraine in the last few months. I've been in Mexico in the last few months. So what is the connection? The connection is that 2015, 2016, I think people know what goes on in the United States in these years in our politics. And I live in Washington, and I got asked over and over, not just once, not just twice, by the seventh or eighth time people came to me. I mean, they didn't just call me on the phone, but I'm having a conversation about an unrelated topic. And then they asked me, I think partly in jest, but also partly out of anxiety, is the United States becoming a fragile state? Well, when that happens over and over again, I have no choice but to say, I need to think hard about this question. I consider my life, and whenever I work on a country, a journey. So I did a journey into the United States, visited lots of places, read lots of books. And my conclusion is, while we may see downstream in our politics and in our rising mistrust and other elements nationally, downstream from these problems, we see national outcomes. I believe the real central issue in terms of our fragility is in the decline of interpersonal relationships. And part of that is the decline in local institutions and the decline of neighborhoods. And so what we're seeing is the society is growing increasingly disconnected. And I would use the term deinstitutionalized, something that's not in my book, but the decline of so many institutions means that we are increasingly socially fragile. And then when we see other problems, whether it's in the health area, whether it's in our politics, whether it's in some other area, it's because of the social fragility. Those things are downstream from the core problem, in my opinion.
Yeah, and you point to the paradox as well. You say right at the very beginning of the book that no country in history has had so much material wealth and so much decay. That seems to be the crucial element here.
Yes, let me just give two statistics. These are, and all the work I did, and as you know from reading the book, Richard, I don't dwell on numbers. I more like to use numbers to highlight trends. But I never start. In fact, when I teach a class at Johns Hopkins, I often tell students, don't let the numbers fool you. You have to understand a context. You have to go deep into studying a country, analyzing its social, political dynamics, and then you use numbers to tell you whether you're doing something right or not, but never start with the numbers because you're going to end up in the wrong place. So I think two data points, which are indicative of what I'm talking about, is the number of people dying from drug overdose in the United States is astounding. It's well over 100,000. It's like 105, 110,000 on an annual basis. That is twice the number of people dying annually than died in the whole 20 years of the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War had protests, had angry, had all sorts of backlash because Americans were suffering, were dying, were getting injured, were coming home not well. And yet we have a catastrophe that's arguably much worse, especially if you look at just the numbers per capita or total numbers, and recurring over and over and over again over years. And it's hard to see any large-scale discussion about this problem. It's in bits and pieces, but mostly not. But I know there's a supply-side problem there in terms of drug cartels and the inexpensiveness and some of the history of pharmaceutical companies. But there's a demand side that something is very missing in our society. And that demand side, so that would be one whole statistic. Why do we have so many people dying of drug overdoses? Why do we have so much suicide? Why do we have so much depression? And you can go on and on and on. I'll give a second statistic we have in the United States. If you look at, I mean, I'm not the first person to point this out. You look at the number of children growing up in a stable family, let's just say a two-parent family, the gap between the United States and Europe is roughly 18 percentage points. That's not a marriage gap. The gap in marriage between the European Union and the United States is 3 percentage points. But the gap in children up to the age of, let's say, 5 that are with two parents in the United States versus Europe, it's a gap of 18 percentage points. So it's not a question of marriage. Europeans are not getting married either to a great extent, especially in the North. And yet we have so many children that are growing up in unstable conditions. And that's something about, that's again, that's about social fragility. That's about the family. It's about interfamily. It's about community. There's all these issues going on. And we, so just in those two statistics, we are suffering, the amount of people suffering, disconnected, not socially supported, is just at a scale that I don't think you see almost anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, it's interesting as well, because you talk about the tyranny of data versus kind of anecdotal experience. I was quite surprised at the beginning where you said that Americans, we don't feel obligated to help our neighbors. And, you know, certainly that is the opposite of my own experience as somebody who isn't American living here. In fact, you know, here in the Hudson Valley in New York, I've been blown away by the generosity that people show to community members during the absolute worst moments that of their life, the things that life has to throw at them. It's genuinely inspiring. And not transactional. So how does that fit? And how do you go about balancing, as you say, those data points, but also the kind of the lived anecdotal experience of people in their local communities?
I think I've certainly found places where what I describe, I live in a wonderful neighborhood. Smaller towns tend to have very good friendly relationships. And so I found four types of places that are exception. One is culturally, one is socially. They have a lot of local institutions. You can think of Park Slope or Chevy Chase in Washington. I think places that are religious, like where I live, maybe places where there's really strong religion. So that would be three. And I found four where they have physically, the place is physically more isolated, and therefore that brings people together. It could be by accident, could be by design. And so I do believe probably in about one quarter of the United States, we still have very, very good close relationships. But I'm not the first person to argue that, broadly speaking, there's a great decline in relationships. I mean, Robert Putnam almost became famous. I would say he did become famous for Bowling Alone in the 1990s. I think his book is 2000 and his original articles a few years before that. Don't quote me on the dates, but you have a whole industry of books. Literally, I mean, I read dozens of books to write my own, and you have loads of people lamenting the decline in relationships, the decline of neighborhoods, the decline of local institutions. So I do believe our individual experience could be quite good. It doesn't take away from lots and lots of data points. And that's experiences. That's Putnam is very heavy on data. But I think broadly speaking, I mean, you can look at Alan Ehrenhardt's book, The Lost City. And he talks, this is again, over 20 years ago, about how much life had changed in a neighborhood between the 50s and the 90s. That's pre-internet and how much it already changed. So I don't think the broad, I think what I've tried to do is pick up from there and ask practically, what can you do about it? But I would say certainly if you have a good neighborhood or if you have a good network, I think this is the key point. For most Americans, we live in networks. We don't live in neighborhoods the way we used to. And if you have a good network, you could be doing really well. But there's lots of places in America that are being left behind. There's a lot of places in America with not good networks. There's a lot of individuals who don't function well with networks or are more comfortable with place-based structures. And so I would argue, and I think a lot of people would agree with this, is that on the whole, we have an enormous decline in those place-based institutions and support structures.
And I wonder how much you feel that is regional, and how much even that you feel it's political. I mean, you talk about Americans being depressed and untethered. I noticed an article in The Economist a week or so ago that pointed out that northern progressives seem to be the ones who are caught in a spiral of depression, and that places like Florida, which are more conservative, seem to actually be happier. I wonder whether that's something that you feel that can actually be stacked up.
Well, that corresponds very much with Jonathan Haidt and other people's data that shows that you're more likely to be happy these days if you're on the right, at least if you're young. I think part of that is on the right, you have more social structures that are supporting you. And this has nothing to do with your politics. It's something about your lifestyle. So think, am I on the left or on the right? I think most people have no idea. And I certainly don't talk politics and I avoid politics. But I live in a neighborhood, probably because of the religious aspects, that people would identify more with the right of center lifestyle. And yet, to be honest, in my neighborhood, I have a lot of signs for Democratic politicians. I'm in Maryland. I'm in Montgomery County. It's a very Democratic part of the country. But my lifestyle is very rich with institutions at the local level. So I think part of what you're seeing in terms of that is lifestyle choices, more respect, more investment in local institutions. However, in terms of your original point, there's clearly a geographical element. If you look at any map of, let's say, social capital in the United States, you get great differences based upon where you are. In general, it's not a right-left because there's high social capital and low social capital in blue as well as red areas. For example, if you go to the South tends to have very bad results in terms of social capital. But if you go to the upper Midwest, it might be also red, but might have very good. And in terms of blue, New England will tend to have very good data, but maybe other blue areas would not. So I tend to think it's not so much your politics as your lifestyle and, yes, where you live. that matters. You can live in a blue or red area that's socially rich, and you can do the same, and you could do the reverse and live in a socially poor neighborhood, and you also could be blue or red. So I do believe we need to separate the two issues.
And it is interesting, and you have a chapter in the book on this about how important customs and practices, traditional customs and practices, in fact, are. And, you know, that tied in very much with another report over the weekend that showed, for example, that church going brings mental health benefits as well. So that there are all kinds of ways in which conservative means something different other than just politics in these kind of instances, that it's about values as much as it is about who you happen to vote for in a presidential election.
Yes, I totally agree with that. I mean, I believe you're referring to an article in the Wall Street Journal, and it's great advertisement. That is my 9:30 a.m. this morning LinkedIn post. So if you want to see it, go to LinkedIn and you will see me discuss that article. So I believe this is not a left-right issue. It's a lifestyle issue. I mean, I did not grow up religious. I decided at some point in my late 20s, when I thought about what is the lifestyle that I wanted to live. And I, to be honest, I mean, there's some tradition in my family. I grew up Jewish, but I didn't grow up religious by any means. When I had a choice to think about how I wanted to live my life, and I thought about what kind of family I wanted to have and what kind of relationships I wanted to have with other people, I mean, it wasn't like I woke up one day, but I did a few things to try and see where I would fit. But I literally had a period of my life where I thought about this question and I chose this particular lifestyle, not because I woke up and I was a born again or something like that, but I thought this was the best lifestyle on many levels. And even when I decided to live where I'm living now, I looked at many, many neighborhoods. So I've been very intentional about choosing the lifestyle and now the neighborhood in the last many years, where I wanted to live, where I wanted my family to live, because I believe that's hugely important. It affects us tremendously. Not all of us have the power or the ability to make these choices, but the extent that we individually, I think there's many policy and larger implications of what we're talking about, but on an individual level, we can surely think hard about these things. And we often make choices that work against relationships. I leaned into this well before I wrote this book, and I've almost had a parallel professional and parallel personal journey that went deep into the idea that relationships matter, and I had to design my life for this purpose.
Yeah, one of the key themes of the book is isolation and loneliness. And of course, there's an irony attached to all of this that, you know, we've never been more connected just at this exact moment that we also seem to be suffering from this epidemic almost of loneliness and isolation.
I think it's true. And I think, I mean, one of the things that's a bit shocking to me, I have foreign eyes. So a little bit like yourself, you probably have foreign eyes at times, Richard, because you grew up in a different country than you live in. I have foreign eyes because I've been fortunate to visit lots of countries, about 75 countries, worked in about 35 countries, and I see America very much through foreign eyes. And one of the shocking things on the broader scale of how we organize our society, we organize our society to isolate ourselves from one another. Everything is thought transactionally. Everything is thought in terms of individualism. Let's just use the example of healthcare, since I know we have Ryan Archer here, who I know worries about healthcare. I'm happy that at least one or two people I know are on the call. And I spent my call at 7 a.m. in this morning with someone working for the Australian government, thinking about how they could recenter their healthcare much more around place. The point is, we as a country, when we build our physical landscape around house with no center, no identity of a neighborhood, no community schools, no local shopping, no local civic associations. We are literally on many, many levels without ever thinking about it. We are systematically designing our physical and our institutional landscape to ensure, almost to promote the idea that we ought to be isolated. And then when we wake up one day and we find out that we are lonely and we are isolated and we have all these negative downstream effects, I think we shouldn't be surprised, because we have done everything from our school policy to our healthcare policy to our urban planning to, I mean, the way we think of government in terms of where money gets spent, how decisions are made, everything about it is almost designed with, again, it's not intentional, but for the sake of efficiency, for the sake of professionalization of nonprofit world, for the sake of often scaling things up and trying to solve big problems, we've actually created millions of small problems. And I think to undo this seems really hard, but it's only going to happen when we are able to incorporate every decision we make, the social implications of the choices we're making, institution by institution, and then society, government as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, these are public questions, they're policy questions. But as you show in the book that, you know, often there are really vicious conflicts between community views and those of funders, whether that's the government, nonprofits, donors, all of these. So it's not as if there already is a consensus and we just need to find a way to implement it. The consensus itself is the thing that is really absent here.
I think, again, look at the trend. We can zero in on a very specific example. I can give you a couple examples. So I would say, in terms of planning, just think that there's a movement called New Urbanism. New Urbanism has existed for over 30 years. The roots of it goes back to Jane Jacobs. But Jane Jacobs and then stuff in the 70s, and I believe New Urbanism is the beginning of the 80s. And that's a whole movement in which the question is there a consensus? I think certainly in terms of the broader planning field, the way government spends money, there is no consensus. But there is this huge movement that's all meant to rethink physical landscape, to do things in a way that's better for social relationships, social ties. I don't think they have a comprehensive enough picture of what that means, but the idea that density would help, sidewalks would help. So you do have a movement, but it doesn't mean you have a larger picture. We could think of some other areas. We could think about how nonprofit world works. The nonprofit world, I think there is much less of a consensus. The nonprofit world used to be lots and lots of local social institutions. You have this, the Tocqueville describes it, and what I would call American Civil Society 1.0 was lots of these ad hoc local institutions. You have what I would call Civil Society 2.0 is what Thetis Scopel and other would describe as these national trans-local organizations with thousands and thousands of chapters, the Rotary Club, American Legion, the Grands. And that thrived through the 60s and then has gone on a very marked decline since. And what you have now and what we don't have is a thriving civil society 3.0. And the question is, how much of that is because of how government money has been centralized? How much of that is because the nonprofit world has become these large hierarchical structures, very professionalized, and very service-oriented? So instead of an organization embedded in a neighborhood or in a very specific place and run by volunteers and dependent upon local funding and dependent upon serving local needs, you have these very siloed professional regional or national organizations. So I would say in that area, by no means is there a consensus, but if you look at the current model and how that affects us, and is there another model that could come up, this 3.0 that I think we really need to discover and catalyze and invest in? Without that 3.0, we have the problems we have now. And how do we go? Of course, there's no consensus because you're stepping on a lot of people's toes and you're disagreeing with how intellectuals, policymakers, they debate policy. And what we're really talking about is something that's actually policy has a role to play, but society is not policy. There's a limit to how much. So I would say there's huge scope there to disagree, but I don't see a way out unless we have civil society 3.0.
A lot of the experience that we've been talking about is suburban, these new builds without sidewalks, without schools, without shops and so on. What about the cities? A lot of major cities in the United States, places like New York and San Francisco, seem to be in crisis at the moment. What do you make of what's going on there?
Well, I think there's a couple of things we can talk about. First, if you're talking about distressed neighborhoods, high concentrations of poverty, I mean, that is very much a problem of cities and inner suburbs. You could look at it outside of these areas, but there's over 825 was the last data point I have, distressed neighborhoods in cities. And so to the extent that, so on one level, you have spatial inequality within cities. I also think what you have is you have a financial model in cities that are not designed to focus on their core strengths. Strong towns, and Chuck Marone has written a lot about this, about the issues that your most valuable assets are in the center, and yet you build out and out, and that's much more expensive to maintain, much less valuable in terms of taxes and real estate. So I do think there's problems about inequality, of spatial inequality. There's problems with the development model that we're adopting. And of course, we have the politics of managing cities. To the extent that we as a country, I would say our most successful places are places in which people are practical, solving problems. Historically, cities were much more practically governed than our national, because they were much more accountable. They couldn't have a deficit. They were close to people. They were more accountable. To the extent that we have a crisis with cities, I would generally be optimistic that the larger cities will have the wherewithal. They have the San Francisco, New York, places like that. They have the cultural institutions. They have enough people who want to steward the place, enough wealth production that they will succeed. There's always the second tier cities that have done really bad over the last 50 years, especially in the upper Midwest. And the question is there a future for them? Is an effort to make our economy more horizontal and less vertical, is that something that could help many places that have been left behind? Because when we talk about cities, we talk about America, we have been too focused on the vertical result, and we've not been focused enough on how each of us are experiencing it, how neighbors are experiencing, individuals, neighborhoods, and lots of, I would say, cities and regions of the country which have not done very well out of the last 40 or 50 years. We need measurements of success that are sideways and not just vertical. And I would say that's hard to produce, but it's something that we desperately need, because we're not measuring success very correctly.
And so, I mean, in that idea of combating problems sideways rather than vertically, which is the major conclusion that you come to at the book, I mean, we're in a presidential election campaign now, Seth. So, you know, my final question is, you know, what is the one policy that you would like to see debated and then enacted when it comes to strengthening the relationships that you talk about in the book? In other words, what would be the single most important practical thing that we could do right now?
As you know, by reading the book, I have attempted to be highly practical. I think most people who write books like this, they don't know what to do at the end. So they tend to be very good on diagnosis and not very good on practical. And I have about 50 suggestions. So I'm going to pick one. I would center the way we organize our society, our government, around neighborhoods. This is the whole point of my book. If everything was thought through, and we could debate what that means in neighborhood and whether it's big or small, but if society was thought about in terms of every neighborhood needs to have an identity, needs to have a boundaries, needs to have a center, needs to have a set of institutions, needs to have some control over what happens and some influence on how government interacts with it, and there was enough wealth production, enough influence, and you could go on and on, and that had an abundance of local institutions that could be business, that could be civic, that could be religious. And we did think about that in a material sense, even though there's a material part of that. It's a lot about is the social dynamics. If we were to center everything we did around flourishing neighborhoods and then work backwards from there, what is the implications of that for how we think about schools? What is the implications for that about how we think of healthcare? What is the implications for that about how we think about how government functions? I would say I'm giving you one place to put your poll down and say, this is what we ought to do. But what I'm saying, it has implications for everything we do in society. Hopefully that's a good enough answer for you, Richard.
So the book is Fragile Neighborhoods, Repairing American Society, One Zip Code at a Time. It's written by my guest, Seth Kaplan, and published by Little Brown. But for now, Seth, congratulations again, and thanks for joining us on Bookstack.
My great pleasure to be with you, Richard.
So that's it from us this week. Don't forget to check our website, AmericanPurpose.com, and to leave us a review on your podcast app. The show is produced by Laura Silverman, and this is me, Richard Alder, saying thanks for listening.